This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Keeping Up with the Kafashians, the place where the threads of medical expertise weave into the fabric of family life. I'm Afif, a neonatologist, deeply intrigued by the earliest stages of life and how our beginnings shape us.
And I'm Anne, an obstetric anesthesiologist with a heart firmly rooted in maternal health and well-being. My passion lies in ensuring safety and comfort during one of life's most remarkable journeys, childbirth.
Together, we navigate the intricate journey of professional practice and personal experience, especially as it pertains to parenting, health, and the profound experience of raising children.
Each episode, we invite you into conversations that bridge the gap between science and the living room, sharing insights from our fields, stories from our lives, and discussions that connect with everyone, from healthcare professionals to parents and those interested in the marvels of human development.
We're here to explore, to question, and to celebrate the incredible journey of life, from the first heartbeat to the first steps and beyond. Welcome to Keeping Up with the Kafashians.
Let's begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Keeping Up with the Kafashians.
Hi.
You had to jump in there.
I know.
So I'm Afif El-Kafash.
And I'm Anne Doherty.
And we are husband and wife. And we work together in the Rotunda Hospital.
Kind of together.
Kind of together. We don't see each other that often.
No.
You try and avoid me, as you said before on
the
baby tribe.
Yeah, quite successfully.
So thank you so much for subscribing. This is the bonus material that you get as part of the Head Stuff Plus network. Thank you so much for subscribing. We are really, really delighted that you have put your faith in us. And we really hope that you are going to enjoy the discussion between myself and Anne. Katie decided that she had enough of me, that she doesn't want to do any...
Look, you're high maintenance at times, Afif. We love you. It's worth it. But it's hard work.
I think that you're hard work as well. And that's why I decided to put you behind a paywall.
No. You're threatened by me. You're threatened by my popularity because I outshone you on the pod.
Well, your episode was the most downloaded episode. And I don't know whether to be happy about that or be annoyed about that.
You're very conflicted about that. And that's okay.
I'm very, very conflicted. But anyway, so what is this podcast about?
Kind of everything to do with parenting, the medical side of things, some sciencey bits that are kind of relevant, either from the baby tribe or from kind of current popular culture. Just an easy access point to healthcare knowledge pertaining to family, pertaining to life. That's it.
Yeah. And sometimes we're going to pick up on some points raised in the baby tribe episodes and expand on them. Avine was great.
Yeah. I was really impressed by the kind of intelligent compassion that she has.
Yeah.
And that's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
She's quite humble about how she approaches things, but the value that she brings is undeniable.
Yeah.
And I think we have a lot to learn from that.
Absolutely. Especially as we said in the on the baby tribe, how diverse Ireland has become. And
yeah.
I feel like I've kickstarted that diversity when I first came here in 1995.
Yeah, they followed you, Afif, definitely, totally. Yeah.
But joking aside, I said on the main episode that I was the only person from the Middle East in my medical class when I first started.
Yeah, but that wasn't true in UCD. We had loads of people from all over the place.
So for people that don't know, me and Anne come from very diverse and disparate cultural backgrounds. I went to Trinity.
And I went to UCD.
And yeah, we started in the same year.
Yeah, and this is the biggest gap between us, the Trinity versus UCD, and it's real.
Forget about the Muslim versus Christian, Arab versus Irish.
No.
It is the UCD versus Trinity that was the sticking point.
It runs deep.
Yeah,
it does. It's deep.
Well, we are the better college.
I know that you think that, Afif. I respect your belief. I will never agree with it. And I would like to bring you back to the fact, where did you do your master's, Afif? Where did you do your MD?
UCD.
There you go.
Yeah,
there
I know. I know. And you know what the funny thing is? Do you remember when we brought our kids to both Trinity
and UCD? And
UCD.
They wanted to go to UCD.
And I remember
bringing Maggie. Because Trinity smells.
So we brought the kids through the arches. And Maggie, who was, I think she was 4 or 5 at the time, she goes, Baba, your university smells of pee. And yeah. I went, we shouldn't have brought her on a Saturday morning through the arches.
So yeah. True, though.
Yeah, exactly. So she wants to go to UCD now, unfortunately. So I've lost one of the children to you.
Yeah, but I think the other one would follow suit as well. Because, my son is very like me.
Yeah,
He's so like me. So he's just going to toddle along now in my direction. It'll be grand. Yeah. I love both of them.
So a lot of what we're going to discuss today is to do with cultural diversity. And we are going to expand a little bit on the paper that I mentioned on the main podcast earlier on, the association between acculturation and the experience of discrimination as a pregnant mother and the wiring of the brain of their babies. We're going to talk about that towards the end. But first of all, we come from different backgrounds ourselves, don't we?
Kind of. In that, like, yes, you're Middle Eastern. Yes, you're Muslim. Yes, I'm from the west of Ireland and I was raised Catholic. So on the surface, I think people would assume we're quite different. But I think we found very early on that we're actually cut from the same cloth in many ways.
We'd a very similar sort of strictish upbringing, didn't we?
Oh, look, the value system's the same. I keep saying it. Like, the Arab mammy school is extremely similar to the good old Irish mammy school. The main difference being that we were raised with the rattle of the wooden spoon as a threat, and ye were raised with a slipper held aloft as a threat. Yes. And that's the difference. That's the primary difference.
Both as effective. I still can't wear flip-flops because it gives me PTSD.
That's brilliant. I have no problem using wooden spoons cooking. Thank God. But it's
wooden spoon versus the flip-flop. Really.
It is. That is the primary difference but they were held aloft for the same reasons.
There's always a threat of the flip-flop. I don't think I ever got a smack.
I got the odd whack on the other side.
I can't remember. Yeah.
You know, I think my mother felt awful if she ever used it, which was exceedingly rare, the threat was usually enough.
Yeah, we had a very similar upbringing, though, in terms of the sort of strictness.
Yeah, our parents, I would have been probably raised in one of the stricter houses.
Yeah.
One of my neighbours, who was like a sister to us, we always say she was the seventh child in the family, the fifth sister. She basically used to get up out of bed, come over to our house in her jammies and have breakfast. Not that they didn't have food in their house, they did. There was just more people in ours. So if we were allowed to go someplace, she was automatically allowed to go if she wanted, because my parents were stricter. And if the Dohertys were allowed to go, then it was generally deemed to be safe.
It was a definitely collectivist way of upbringing.
Yeah, we had a fabulous road. We were blessed with it. Like, there would be 10, there was 6 kids in my house. But inevitably, like, this was the 80s, so there would be 10 kids in the car going to the beach, because it was a case of somebody's going to the beach, everybody pile in. And that was how it went.
Those were the days where everybody was rattling in the back of the car.
Oh, yeah. The dirtiest children went in the boot.
Yeah.
Because the sandiest ones, the ones that were like pretty much swallowing sand, went in the boot on the way home.
Boot of an estate, though, not a saloon, I'm assuming.
No, it was a saloon at times.
Oh, wow.
We were little. Okay. I'm still not that tall, Afif.
I did have to lower the legs on the tripod to film her for the reel.
Well, that's okay. That's okay too.
Yeah. We had a similar upbringing. We, interestingly, we had a sort of a collectivist upbringing, but it was episodic in that, the whole family got together over the weekends. Yeah. In my grandmother's house, and we sort of lived there for the weekend. But during the week, we were in an apartment block, so we sort of raised on our own. So we had a...
You were in an apartment block, and downstairs was...
What?
Your aunt.
Yes, that was before.
Okay.
Yeah, that was before. This was before the war. Okay. We were in an apartment block. Afterwards, exactly, it was a collectivist type of upbringing where we had upstairs of a house, and my aunt downstairs of a house, and... Yeah. I remember I used to always eat in my aunt's house because the food was better than in our house. And my aunt loved it.
Your mother is going to hear this in Kuwait, and you'll be getting phone calls.
She used to tease my mother all the time, saying, my food's better than yours. They were sisters, And so it was great.
It's a wonderful way to grow up, you see.
But it's funny how it sort of affected us differently in terms of how we parent. Whereas I maintain the strictness and you are a bit less strict, not in a bad sense, but in a way of...
I'm a collaborator. If my kids want to do something and I feel like they're at an appropriate level of maturity, that it's like developmentally it's right for them. You know, like there's no point in like, you know, my 12-year-old going, I want to go to a club. Like that's not going to happen. But if they're at an appropriate level age-wise for that, then we sit down and we have a chat about like what my misgivings are. They have to figure out a way to deal with those.
Guys, there was PowerPoint presentations, I kid you not, coming from the kids.
Yeah, but they... And now they're teaching their friends and their friends are using it. Yeah. And it works.
Yeah.
They address, it's brilliant. But like even the younger one who would have been the happy-go-lucky, I'll saunter through life and take things, make my judgments as they come, is now starting to preempt what our concerns are going to be in a way that he has to take them on board. And it means that they then have to show us that they understand what the concerns are and how they're going to ensure that we're okay with it.
Yeah.
So it's actually really, really helpful, I think. It helps them grow up.
And it's very much the way that Niamh Kavanagh, who was the first guest in season 3 of the Baby Tribe podcast, has raised her kids.
Yeah.
I think she was ahead of her time doing it. And I remember her saying that she, you know, would really relate to you because me, the default was, no, you can't do this without giving, you know, a reason. Just because of my, I suppose, prejudice and fear about what might happen.
But I think, you see, I think that everybody has their own fears about what might happen. And I don't think, like, anything could happen at any time. You know, probability-wise, you know, anything could happen. Some things are more likely than others, right? So every fear and every concern is valid. It just has to be communicated in a way that it can be addressed. And that's why... Just say no because I said so doesn't really help, because I grew up with a lot of no because I said so. And it just drove me nuts because you can't discuss your way past that. And it took me a while to nearly like Maggie, like our daughter is educating us. It took me a while to educate my parents in that way to say, well, how am I meant to figure this out with you if no because I said so is all I get, like. I had to figure that out, and now the kids are teaching us. And you do, they're training us, essentially.
Yeah, and I've come on board with that now.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Admirably so, actually. Fair play to you.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. And then moving on to the cultural diversity.
Our kids love being Arab and Irish.
Yeah, I think they use it to their advantage.
Yeah.
They celebrate everything.
They do.
Yeah.
They're brown when they want to be. And they're pale when they want to be.
Yeah, whichever is the coolest at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
They'll decide to be that.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we're raising Faisal to be a perfect espionage with 3 passports.
Are we allowed to say that?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Yeah.
For some reason, a few thinks we can say anything on this podcast, and I'm not so sure.
It's behind a paywall. Like I said, no one's listening. No one's listening.
This is really just a documentary for the family, is it?
Exactly. No one's listening. Yeah. So Faisal has 3 passports because he was born in Canada.
Yeah.
His mother's Irish. Yeah. And his dad is a Jordanian citizen. He's a citizen of all those 3 states.
Yeah.
So he can go anywhere. He can be anything. Yeah. So very, very interesting. And I think Maggie finds it annoying that Faisal has one more citizenship.
He loves throwing the Canadian citizenship in her face.
Yeah.
He loves it.
Yeah.
He just amps that up because she thinks, you know, she's nearly 16. So she's telling me, oh, I'm going to Australia. I'm going to Canada. I'm going to all of these places. It's going to be amazing. And I'm like, that's wonderful. And then Faisal will just be like, I'm not so sure you can go to Canada that easily. Like, and he'd be nearly waving it in her face. Like.
As a Canadian citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the other day you heard him invoking the Maple Leaf Oath, whatever that is. He made that up. So I'm going to Toronto in May for a conference. And then he says, Dad, I have to come with you. And I said, no, you don't. He's like, Dad, as a Canadian citizen, I'm invoking the Maple Leaf Oath. And I said, oh, really? What is that? He's like, it is an oath that every parent that removes a Canadian citizen from the land must return them by the age of 13 for a visit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, really?
It has to be complete BS. Now, please, if there's any Canadians listening, clearly only Canadian members of our family, because nobody's going to listen. But please text us and let us know.
It doesn't exist. I looked it up.
He made it up.
Of course not.
Good man, no, thinking on his feet.
Not. Yeah.
Fair play to him.
And it was a pain in the bum, because now Canada need a sort of pre-clearance thing, just like the American ESTA that you have to apply online. Yeah. And we haven't renewed his Canadian passport since he was a baby. And then when I tried to do an ESTA for him on his Irish passport and I had to put place of birth Canada, it basically shut down and said a Canadian citizen must enter Canada as a Canadian. Mm. You can't. And so I had to go and get him his Canadian passport again, which actually looks pretty cool. It's got cool pictures and images and maple leaves. It's a lot cooler than the Irish passport.
That's good.
Yeah. Anyway, so we are quickly going to talk about study that I brought up during the main episode. We sort of skimmed over it. And you have...
I'm going to set a little scene here for a second, Afif. Afif talked to me about this study a while ago.
So I'm going to read the study. Let me just summarize the study for you, okay? So the study explores how discrimination and acculturation experienced by pregnant women, particularly in a predominantly Hispanic adolescent population, this was done in the States, might influence the neural connectivity of their newborn. So what they did was they looked at the experience of mothers during the pregnancy, whether they experienced discrimination or acculturation, and then they did MRI scans of the baby's brains after delivery at around 6 weeks of age. And they specifically wanted to look at connections involving the amygdala, the frontal lobe, and the fusiform gyrus. And we're going to talk about what these things do in your brain in a minute. What I actually found is that higher levels of assimilation in mothers were associated with weaker connectivity between the newborn's amygdala and the bilateral fusiform gyrus, while experiences of discrimination were linked to weaker connectivity between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. So those results suggest that prenatal experiences of discrimination and acculturation could affect brain development in ways that potentially influence the baby's future perception and reaction to discrimination, possibly perpetuating a cycle of discrimination across generations. And I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, you interrupted my scene setting.
Sorry. Let me...
it's fine.
Let me interrupt your intelligence with my confidence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's fine. So when you did tell me about this study and you were really excited, you were like, that's amazing. That's wow. And I just said, I call bullshit, is what I said.
You
got really offended.
I did.
Oh my God, you were so like insulted. And I said, well, like, have you read the paper in full? And you said, well, no, I'm in the process of reading it. And I said, well, like, we can't be making these kind of reductive, generalized kind of statements saying that how it was originally presented to me was that the discrimination that a pregnant woman experiences alters her baby's brain.
Yep.
Right? And I thought, that seems a little bit oversimplified there now. And would you think that that statement accurately reflects what this paper shows?
Well, there are limitations.
I think there are.
But I think it's interesting concept nonetheless.
I think it's actually a dangerous thing to say that an experience of discrimination or acculturation, because people are going to perceive this as damages a baby. And that's not what this paper is saying. And I think you have to be really careful with that. Can I tell you what my opinion is on it?
Before we do that, can we explain briefly what those three parts of the brain do?
Okay, I think go it's first. You do that.
Relevant. Cool, you want me to cool. do that?
Yeah, go first.
Okay, so we...
But keep it like...
Keep it simple.
No, keep it light.
Keep it light. Okay. So
keep it simple. Go on.
So the amygdala, it's a small almond-shaped cluster of brain cells that are located deep within the temporal lobes. And those lobes are the basically sides of the brain that sit beside our temple. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And they play a crucial role in processing emotions, emotional behavior, and motivation. They also deal with social processing, decision-making, our response to anxiety and stress and fear conditioning. Is that fair enough?
For a long time, we used to think that the amygdala was just the fear center. And it was like hardwired into the fight or flight kind of response. So now we know that it's an awful lot more to do with that sense of kind of community recognition. And that's nearly like the opposite to fear, if you think about it, like that security, comfort kind of thing. Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to study.
Yeah. Frontal lobe then. It's the largest part of the kind of major four lobes of the brain. Sits at the front of the brain. And it's, you know, related to personality and emotional expression.
Executive function as well.
Executive function. We've mentioned that a lot in our Baby Tribe podcast. Mm. So listeners, go back to the episodes where we delve deeply into executive function. Speech production, impulse control. We usually say, I'm a bit frontal today when you don't have a filter. Isn't that right?
Disinhibited, yeah.
I'm a bit disinhibited. Exactly. Yeah. So together, the amygdala and the frontal lobe are actually fundamental in shaping how we respond to the world around us, including how we think, feel and behave. And then finally, the bilateral fusiform gyrus. It's a brain region located at the bottom surface of the brain. It's part of the temporal lobe as well. One of the most well-known functions of the fusiform gyrus is involved in facial recognition. So it's particularly adept at distinguishing faces from other types of objects, suggesting specialized role in human and social interactions by enabling individuals to recognize and interpret faces of others. Anything else?
No, that's fair enough. But tie it all together then.
Yeah, because what I thought was interesting about the study is that it showed problems with connectivity between those three areas of the brain. And I think before we go into the limitations, I just think it's interesting because if the findings are true, then it may suggest that if a mother experiences discrimination during pregnancy, then this discrimination through altered brain connectivity may involve a mechanism whereby the stress that you experience during the pregnancy, including discrimination and assimilation, influences the developing brain architecture, especially in those areas that are involved in emotional processing, social cognition, and facial recognition. And then this could affect the child's future social interactions, emotional regulation, and perception of social cues. And over time, these may actually affect social behaviors and attitude that further contribute to, you know, intergenerational transmission of discrimination.
Okay, so my thoughts.
Yeah.
First of all, when they talked to these women, and they were all women of minority, and they asked for self-reported measures. Okay, so they got various different questionnaires that looked at various different measures of things like discrimination. So it was self-reported incidences of discrimination. So how many times have you felt discriminated against in the last X amount of time? And that was a numerical thing. And they looked at that in each trimester in these women. Any self-reported measure, there's a bias inherent in that. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean that these women aren't experiencing this, but experiences are subjective and that has to be taken into account. So if somebody is raised in a situation where they're in a family that's extremely aware of discriminatory experiences versus a family who, put it this way, our kids, they're Arab, okay, but they went to a multicultural school and they still go to a multicultural school and they've never really felt that any negativity about being Arab. Another family in the same school may have experienced previously a lot of discrimination. And their kids may be raised with an awareness of discrimination and they may perceive more discrimination in the same circumstance because of how they were raised, whether or not that's an objective discrimination. Okay, do you understand what I mean?
I do.
So that's a subjective thing. And I know you're going to go back to the multi-generational stuff because of what I've said, but there is an inherent bias in these self-reported measures. The acculturation, what they did was they looked at, they did a questionnaire and then they put people into one of three categories, okay? Integration, so they're completely, if you move to Ireland and you become completely Irish and you identify as Irish and you only identify as Irish. Assimilation, where you identify as, say, both Arab and Irish, similar to our kids. Or marginalization, where you only identify as your culture of origin, not being identified in any way as Irish.
Isn't integration the one where you identify with both and assimilation where you lose your original culture?
Yes, you're right. Sorry, I've got it wrong. Yeah. Okay, so they were put into one of those three categories.
Yeah.
Again, this is all perceived stuff. This is very subjective. So all of that is a subjective assessment. And it's hard, as you know, as a researcher, when you're doing this kind of qualitative rather than quantitative assessment and you're putting a measurement on something that's very subjective. It's very hard to do this cleanly, okay, without any overlap. And then what they did was they MRI'd the baby 6 weeks later after birth. And they found that those patients, those people who said that they experienced a lot of discrimination, so identified with experiencing discrimination in life scenarios, or who felt who were marginalized, okay, so had not developed community within the host nation, we'll call them.
Yeah.
Okay. Had less connectivity between the amygdala and the frontal cortex and the
fusiform.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of inherent biases in that within those 6 weeks postnatally, if you are embedded within a community that has multiple cultures, multiple races, and you're deeply embedded within that community, that child will actually see more faces, different kinds of faces, be more socialized, and therefore experience a different kind of community.
You're suggesting that post-delivery environmental factors may explain those connectivity differences.
And I don't think that you can completely outrule that.
Yeah.
And that's why I would say that in a study like this, saying that being marginalized in pregnancy, I don't want it to ever anybody to ever think that it damages the baby's brain. It doesn't do that. Okay. It's not that these babies had damage in their brain. It just meant that their wiring at 6 weeks postpartum was different.
Different, exactly.
Okay. Not that it was broken.
Yes.
And I think it's really important.
And we don't know whether these changes become less and less different as the child grows.
Yeah, because it's not been
because
studied.
One thing we've spoken about a lot is the plasticity of the brain, yeah, early on, that you can actually influence how the brain develops,
yeah,
by your environmental,
yeah,
exposures.
I think separate to all of the etiology, the fact that there's less connectivity in these children who may be more isolated is interesting. And it's also, you know, if you want to extrapolate it cautiously, the top-down regulation of the amygdala, okay, means that you consciously try and regulate that sense of fear and isolation, okay, as you grow older. And that's why you need a good connectivity between the part of your brain that really thinks and the part of your brain that feels and reacts.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's important.
Yeah.
But it is interesting because it shows that, you know, multi-generational isolation, a lack of community, you know, can potentially influence how these kids can socialize without anxiety and fear as they grow older.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is what I would take out of this study, that we need to have community. The other thing that I found really interesting in it, but I wasn't surprised, was that, okay, this was a study done in the US,
yeah, yes,
on ethnic and minority patients. And there was a trend, there was a very small study, I think they only studied about 38 mother and baby pairs, but there was a strong trend toward association between discrimination or acculturation stressors with fetal birth outcomes, okay? So the babies who had more discrimination and acculturation in their mothers had poorer fetal outcomes in terms of wellness, okay, your neonatal wellness. And I think that really just reflects the really well-known difficulty in the American healthcare system for ethnic minorities to get access to good healthcare. These patients, the American maternal mortality is over three times that of the Irish maternal mortality. And a lot of that is due to access. You know, we have to try and protect our low-cost healthcare in this system, you know, at the point of the patient. Obviously, it costs the government a lot, and that's why we pay taxes. But we have to try and protect that. And we also have to get better at ensuring that our minorities are homeless, are refugees, people of lower socioeconomic income, and people of ethnic minority groups have good access to healthcare. It is imperative, and it does have multi-generational problems if we don't create that for them. So as well as maintaining access to healthcare, we need to build communities and we need to relate to others that we see as being different to us. And finding a way to find that compassion and empathy can be difficult. And I know in terms of healthcare, we get more and more people coming in, especially in the Rotunda catchment area, different languages, different cultures, different religions, different approaches to labour delivery, decision making, all of that. And you have to find a way to relate. There's something that I wrote before relating to that struggle that I find. And there's certain people that you take with you the whole way through. You find this as well, I'm sure, Afif. There's people that you take, there's cases and people that you've met that you take with you throughout your career where you've learned something that's pretty much indelible. It's in you now and it's something that you'll take with you the whole way. And there was one particular case that made me realize that every stranger, regardless of color of skin, regardless of any of that, every stranger that we see in healthcare is completely unified by the same struggles and the same needs in life. Sometimes I write down what I've learned in a way that I can reread it and kind of refocus in on it when I need to. So this is it. It's early in a new shift in ED. I know that if it was the end of a tough shift with an exhausted team, it might be more atmospheric, but it didn't happen like that. We're cheerful, joking, just getting on with it. A resource call comes through and we assemble like a little army of healthcare. He arrives with two deeply focused EMTs already far into the drill. Clipped, efficient, accurate communication. Pedestrian versus large van. CPR ongoing, 30 minutes. No defibrillator shocks advised. GCS3, pupils greater than 4 millimetres, unreactive, spinal precautions in place, possible trauma injuries listed. Smooth transfer to resus bed, CPR continues. Monitors applied, no shock indicated. IV drugs, primary surgery, we all get busy. I stand at the head of the bed and prepare to intubate his airway. Tube passed smoothly while spinal cord protected, but we can see that this is futile. His injuries are unsurvivable. Time passes, drills completed. We await confirmation of our fears. Chaplain called, CPR continues. And that's when I see past the process. He's the most popular guy in the room. All eyes are on him. Clothes hastily removed to allow this strange intimacy. My eyes fall on a shoe lying on its side on the floor. Wet leaves poking out. Stuck to the sole. His tie dropped beside it. And then I see it. A light pink hair tie tangled with wispy blonde hairs around his right wrist. His familiar morning routine opens up in front of me. The cozy disorder of a family home in the morning. Breakfast table in disarray. Ponytail duty with gentle encouragement brushing away the bedhead. Hairstyle debates. The sight of a child's hand holding the cereal spoon. A hasty wave and maybe a kiss goodbye. The dark morning. The smell of wet leaves underfoot after a night's rain. Today all that stops with a knock on the door and the first of so many sympathetic conversations. The chaplain arrives with last rites administered. She leans down and whispers into his ear softly. But with purpose. Courage, courage, don't be afraid, you're not alone. That breaks me. I remember this man more and more. He's my reference for all situations where I need to make an effort to find common ground, to relate to another human being. He taught me that even when separated by the greatest cognitive distance or the most bizarre circumstances, there is unity in our day-to-day struggles. I think of him when I watch the news and hear calculated, dispassionate discussion of the fallout from war, or when I hear someone talk about cultural differences as if other humans are alien. We are all connected by the fragility of life. I think that everyone has a light pink hair tie with wispy blonde hair on their wrist.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.